Linoleum Knife,
a podcast of the cinema.
Welcome to another episode of Zoom meeting quality audio.
Yes, indeed.
Starring me, Dave White. I'm a film critic. And then Alonzo Duralde, who is my husband and also a film critic. He's the reviews editor for The Wrap, co-hosts a lot of other podcasts. Who cares what they're called right now? Also, we have a guest
we
today.
Do.
The guest who we promised last week and then he bounced on us because he's selfish, but now he's back. He's here, and we're going to screw up our sound quality again just for him.
That's right.
Robert Abley of the Welcome. Los Angeles Times and many other locations.
Film critic, but not one of your husbands.
Exactly, yes.
Not one of my many husbands.
I am a husband, just not one of your husbands.
You're the husband to the co-host, the third host of Linoleum Knife and Fork,
yes,
Margie the Rocklin.
Right.
That
the
is,
spoon
that is correct.
Of Linoleum Knife and Fork, indeed.
Yep. That is true.
So Robert's joining us to talk about the new movies of this week. But before we get into that, were there any thoughts about, since you weren't able to join us for your annual slot in our year in review episode, was there anything about 2020 that you wanted to get on the record before we move past it all?
I have completely forgotten about 2020 now.
I think that's probably for the best for all of us.
No, I mean, look, I mean, you know, my favorite movie of the year was Time by Garrett Bradley. So,
Which we need to catch up on this show. We have not.
Yeah, we haven't even seen it yet.
Yes, but it is on our list of stuff to get to. We will also next week be getting to One Night in Miami, which I mentioned briefly last fall.
Wonderful.
Yeah, I reviewed it out of Venice. It is now on Amazon Prime. We will talk about it next week. But one of this week's catch-up films is also on Amazon Prime. It actually dropped on Christmas, and we're finally now getting to it. And that is Sylvie's Love, which is a really lovely period romance starring Tessa Thompson. And I always mess up this guy's name. Is there anybody who wants to tackle the correct pronunciation?
I'm just going to say Nnamdi.
Okay. Yeah, Nnamdi Asamoah, who was an NFL vet. I did not know this until after seeing the movie, because what do I know from sports? But he's great in this, and so is Tessa Thompson. So yeah, it's a very old school film. It begins in 1962. We flash back to 1957, and then it kind of is set through the 50s and 60s. And it has a very old school lushness to it. In my review for The Wrap, I compared it to the films of Ross Hunter, the producer. And then later read director Eugene Ash said that it was his goal to make a Black Doris Day movie. So I was like, you have succeeded, sir. So yeah, Tessa Thompson plays Sylvie. She is, when we meet her in 1957, she is engaged to be married to the son of a very successful doctor. She works in her father's record store in Harlem, but she's very interested in television and wants to go into television, even though there aren't a lot of Black women in television, at least that she knows about. She meets Robert, played by Asmuga, who is a jazz musician who's in New York for the summer. They hit it off, even though she is, like I said, engaged to somebody else. But he eventually goes off to Paris to go play jazz. And when they're crossed paths again 5 years later, she is married, she has a child, but she has also found a way to get into the TV business and is working her way up the ladder. And things are rekindled between them. And it goes from there. It's beautiful to look at. It's got great jazz music, two really appealing leads. And when we talk about you know, film like on Who Shot You, whenever we talk about films that are about the Black experience or the queer experience or that are feminist movies or whatever, we kind of discuss whether or not these are movies about the struggle. And this is a Black film that is not about the struggle. It is not about, you know, it's set during the civil rights era, but it is about people living their lives and pursuing their dreams, and not every moment of their lives is sort of dominated by the struggle, you know, in this country. And it's a gorgeous piece of escapism, and it's just a lovely, lovely romance, I thought.
And yet it's not as if the struggle is like absent. I mean, what you like about a movie like this is it's kind of giving you a sense of what, if we'd been able to get movies about Black people in the 50s and 60s,
sure,
from mainstream Hollywood, you know, what that might have looked like. And that's kind of what the wonderful kind of nostalgic fantasy of the movie is that it's like trying to make up for lost time. And I mean, it's a kind of a clunky movie at times. It's not always like, you know, smooth, but it all the pleasures it gives you, you're so happy for, because you just have not gotten movies like this.
The swoonification of it all. I understand what Robert's talking about in terms of, you know, filmmaking. It's good filmmaking. But occasionally there are moments where you're not feeling, you know, as smooth of an enterprise as it wants to be. But oh my God.
The pleasures.
I forget sometimes that love stories in film can make you feel things, because it's done a lot, but it's never done especially well. And I shouldn't say never. That's harsh. But it is so much more the exception than the rule for me that I come out of a love story feeling it. And what it takes is more than just a script and competent direction and, you know, beautiful people. It takes this unnameable thing that actors can create together and make you believe it and make you feel it. And they do. And it's utterly gorgeous. And you're rooting for them, and you're not worried too much for them, because the film isn't, like, as you said, it's not presenting tense obstacles in their way.
Right.
It's presenting everyday kind of obstacles that you think to yourself, well, if love's going to conquer all, get conquering. And it does. And so I adore this.
Because these are two industries that you could see people like, even an oppressed minority making inroads in. And so that's believable, especially in jazz, you know, in TV.
Sure.
So you're these characters are allowed their ambitions, and you get to see that as well as their love story, which is great.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, I think so often there's been this desire of, I think starting in the late 60s and the 70s, where this notion of, if you were going to make a period piece, you had to be really like commenting about it. You had to sort of like, it was about how uncool and corny these movies were, and how they weren't paying attention to the realities of the world around them. And this is a movie that is just like, no, we're going to embrace not the world of the 1950s, but the cinema of the 1950s. We're going to embrace the sort of, again, like Ross Hunter, when he was making, you know, those Douglas Sirk movies or the Doris Day comedies or whatever, was not interested in reality in the slightest. He was not interested in like the gritty, even for white people, what their day-to-day lives were in post-war America. It was about, you know, gowns by Jean Louis and, you know, like the hairstyles by Sidney Gilaroff and, you know, diamonds provided by Bulgari and you know, like, so this is just a movie about people looking great and falling for each other and getting to fulfill themselves in their chosen fields, you know, and it doesn't feel the need to sort of retroactively talk about what a lie that was, you know.
And also melodramatic plot points that you enjoy. I mean, you know, it's misunderstandings that in real life, you know, probably wouldn't happen, but in a movie like this are needed, and sure. you kind of sink into them because they do help move the story along. And I just love, like, and also the period thing. I mean, clearly, Eugene Ash, the writer director, I mean, his music taste is exquisite. So like all the music choices are just, I mean, like, yes, you fall in love to Nancy Wilson, and you, but also, like, you get to hear, you know, Cecile McLaurin-Salvon at the end too. You know, it's like his sense of, like, the pop jazz landscape of the time is just fantastic.
Sorry.
This is the burden of being on Zoom, and yes. You and I are not even in the same room. Mm. None of the music choices are obvious. Right. Like, there are times if I'm watching a film set in the 50s or 60s, I think, all right, when are we going to hear song X or song Y? Because the music supervisor is going to, you know, fill in the blank with the most generic, immediately understandable thing that they can. And that's not happening here. This is a music lover's film.
Yeah.
And the period detail, which I'm a big stickler on for this sort of film, is not just great, but it feels like human beings live in these spaces.
Yes.
Sometimes the cars are a little too shiny, but that's, it's fine. It's gorgeous from top to bottom.
But the archival inserts of the cities were fantastic. They were really smoothly done. What is clearly archival footage was really well handled as establishing shots.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this was shot in 16, so, like, it gives it a little more texture than digital post-production might have. It's weirdly enough, I watched this the same day that I watched Soul. So they make a very nice kind of jazz double feature in terms of, like, you know, New York City movies about, you know, people who love music. And if you're watching Bridgerton right now, Roger Jean Page pops up as one of the fellow band members, you know, so he looks as good in a 50s suit as he does in, you know, breeches.
Also, it was nice to see Lance Reddick get a role that wasn't like some officious like cop or you know, figure of authority. He's like a happy dad, you know.
Yes.
He's like, it's good for Lance Reddick.
Dave, were you gonna say something?
I was thinking about how in the early 90s, after the new queer cinema and the queer films that hit the mainstream were largely fluffy and divorced from reality, with the exception of, like, Jeffrey, which was fluffy and based in reality at the same time. But you got a lot of films that felt disconnected.
Billy's for me, Hollywood anyway. Screen Kiss.
Yeah, these films felt disconnected from me or my life. And so I'm looking at this movie and I'm thinking, you know, obviously I'm white. And that's a thing that becomes, you know, do I know if this story is disconnected? But it doesn't feel like it. It feels like, as you said, a story that is about love above all else, but feels also grounded in the reality of Black people's lives in that era. And I think that is one of the things that makes it satisfying. Because I never felt satisfied by the mainstream queer films that came out after the films that were about the struggle, right?
Sure. Right,
in the early 90s. Yeah, and so that's one of the things that I really adore about this.
Well, yeah, because I mean, like, the movie will do something along the lines of, like, okay, for example, the whole setup with the fiance, you know, it's very much about, like, you know, he comes from this wealthy family So, you know, you get these sort of traditional rom-com, but romance setups where she's engaged to the rich guy, she's in love with the poor musician, but it's all within the context of like black life in America. You know, his father is a successful black doctor. You know, Sylvie's mother is like Harlem's most, you know, terrifying etiquette coach. Like she is so super strict about deportment and all that kind of stuff. And so, it's within a black framework and black context, but it's still people living their lives and making choices and doing that stuff. By the way, the mother is played by Erica Gimple. We were trying to figure out where we recognize her from there. She was on God Friended Me, your favorite show.
Yes.
And she was Coco on the Fame TV show.
She was on the Fame TV show. That was the first thing I was going to say. Yeah. She was on Fame. I forgot. That's right. But yeah, no, the characters do talk about this stuff.
Yeah.
It's not like they are, it's not like they're divorced from, yeah, you know, the political reality of that moment.
The cousin winds up like going to the South to like register voters and stuff. So like, that's not ignoring, you know, the historical context. It's just not trafficking in tragedy, you know?
Yeah. And the job opportunity for the fiance at one point later has that.
Oh yeah. Like, they're very explicit about like, you're going to be the token guy at our firm. So we don't get sued by the NAACP.
It's probably the most, that's probably the most overt,
acknowledgement,
you know, acknowledgement of the era that they were in.
Yeah, so this is terrific, and it is now streaming on Amazon Prime. Folks should check it out.
And Asamuga, by the way, I just think Asamuga is like, he's one of those guys, you just want to watch him, you know, he's such a wonderfully kind of like in-the-moment actor, where you can just, I could see in 10 years that we're all going to be talking about him as a guy, you'll watch him do anything.
No, this is a star-making performance, and again, literally, I had no idea who this guy was, and I found out later, okay, like, because usually when an NFL guy goes into movies, there's a trajectory involved, and it usually involves like action cinema or something where the physicality is really important. But here he plays a guy who wears glasses convincingly. I'll say that.
I will say this.
Expect from an ex-jock.
I mean, I don't know because I haven't read an interview where he would have talked about this, but like the position he played in football was a cornerback, not quarter, but cornerback, which is a very like, you have to know a lot of different, you have to be able to do a lot of different things defensively and offensively. Mm. And I'm guessing it helps, it's good training for an actor to want to know how to do different things and to know how to approach learning to do different things. And it probably is going to stand him in good stead.
I was reminded by Christy on Breakfast All Day that he plays himself on the Kroll show and marries one of the Liz's in publicity.
It's Beast in Our Name.
Exactly. So before we move on to our next film, real quick, yes.
Did Amber Petty re-up for another ad?
Amber Petty re-up for another ad.
Good, because she's the only one.
And look, the year is just starting. I'm sure we'll hear back from our dear, dear friends. Want to try freelance writing but have no idea where to start? Join Amber Petty for her free workshop, 3 Key Steps to Becoming a Freelance Writer. In this 60-minute workshop, she'll walk you through the basics of how freelance writing works and what you need to do to get started, even when you have zero samples or experience. Plus, just by showing up, you'll get a bonus tool to help you organize your story ideas and get a special offer for Amber's upcoming course. The workshops are this Thursday, January 21st at 5:30 p.m. Pacific, or next Saturday, January 23rd at 11 a.m. Pacific, or Wednesday, January 27th at 7 p.m. Pacific. The first workshop is this Thursday, and she says not having a maniac for a president will make it more fun. Knock wood. To sign up for free, head to amberpetty.com/linoleum. No code required. Just go to amberpetty.com/linoleum.
It would behoove you not to be one of those folks that listens to this show 6 months after the episode drops, because you're out of luck.
This is true.
If you want to take the Amber Petty course and join the Amber Petty lifestyle.
Yes.
And I feel like as a longtime freelancer, I could probably stand a refresher course in those very things.
Well, now you know where to go.
That's right.
So also premiering this weekend, a movie I liked a lot, and it was kind of shot. It's one of those things where, like, you know, when I'm reviewing to embargo, people always accuse film critics of like, oh, we collude and people don't want to, like, you know, go against the grain. But like when you're reviewing with an embargo, you put it out in the world and then you find out later what everybody else thought. But I really, really like HBO Max's Locked Down, and discovered that not everybody felt the same way. But I don't know. I'll be fascinated to hear what Robert has to say about it. So this is written by Stephen Knight, who did Locke and Serenity and a whole bunch of other stuff, Peaky Blinders, and directed by Doug Liman. Anne Hathaway and Chiwetel Ejiofor play a couple who are in London in the early parts of the COVID-19 lockdown. It's like February, March, you know, not that long after Christmas, because they keep talking about it. And their relationship has reached a point where if it weren't for the lockdown, they probably wouldn't still be under the same roof because they're barely talking to each other. He is, used to be a sort of devil may care biker, but now he works as a truck driver. She works for an international marketing conglomerate that she is growing to loathe more and more. And when it turns out that he's going to be the truck driver transporting a diamond from an exhibition at Harrods that her company put on, they realize that they might actually have an opportunity to pull off a heist. If this movie were just about the heist, it would be the dumbest heist ever because it's literally just handed to them. But what the movie is really about is, I think, how the pandemic has forced a lot of people, whether they have dealt with personal, you know, loss or illness in their own life or not, just by virtue of the lockdown, to maybe sort of start asking themselves bigger questions about what am I doing with my life anyway? And do I want to keep doing that with my life when this whole thing maybe is over? And I dug it on all of those levels. And I really think that, like, the two of them have great chemistry. They've got great scenes on their own and together. As we know, at least I think as podcasters, because of Zoom, it's been easier to get bigger names than you might have otherwise. Certainly it's helped a film and a movie out a lot. So, you know, we get little moments from like Ben Kingsley and Ben Stiller and Stephen Merchant and, why am I blanking on her name from The Office?
Mindy Kaling.
So
from
you know,
Office. How about from her own freaking TV show?
I never saw her show. I know, The Mindy Project. Yes, okay. Yes. Anyway, she's, you know, I was introduced to her on The Office, so she's always going to be from The Office for me. Anyway, I dig this movie a lot, and I think I watched it again with Dave, who I believe also enjoyed it, but he can tell you himself. But Robert, your thoughts?
This is not a movie that gave me many thoughts. I did understand what they were trying to do. I didn't think based on, you know, Stephen Knight, yeah, he's a wonderful writer. He also, you didn't mention Dirty Pretty Things, which Chiwetel Ejiofor, you could argue was the movie that made us all sit up and take notice about him.
Sure.
Yeah, he's a smart writer. I just thought the attempt to kind of graft a heist onto this, why not just tell the story of this relationship? I mean, you could have picked two different, I just thought I didn't really buy them. But I bought them in moments. And it's a lot of the things about this movie. It's like there are moments that you like. There were, like, you know, details about a crazy Zoom call that you believe. There are details about, you know, being in an empty city in a pandemic that you believe. But just overall, it was just not a story that I kind of got into. And I wish they just kind of focused on making a marital drama.
I cared less about their relationship than about the operation of the heist and the why of the heist. Because it is, as you said in the description, I don't want to, you know, give too much away, but it is a heist that could not happen without Harrods shutting down. And so in the process, I don't know if Harrods really shut down. I mean, I know they shut down, but I don't know if they had everything removed from the store or not or whatever. But the whole heist revolves around them having to take everything out of Harrods's. Mm-hmm. And make that go. And as it unspools, you get the feeling of, you know, this is a rebellion of people against bigger forces. And someone late in the film says, I want everybody to steal everything. And I sat on the couch and I said, yeah. Heist movies are one of my favorite genres. And it's because of that old, you know, remember when you were a little kid and they said, reading unlocks your imagination and you can go to all these different places and land in space and, you know, other countries. When I'm watching a heist movie, that is the one time in my life when I feel like I could do this. I could be in a heist and I'll be in a heist someday and it's going to be great and I'm going to be rich and it's going to be, and when we're done, we're going to be happy because we've heisted money from somebody who's wicked and evil, like Bank of America or someone like that. So as I'm watching the heist portion, you know, the heist moments of this, I'm thinking, yeah. It doesn't give you great heist tension.
No, not particularly.
No.
But again, just the very process of it made me happy. What I did appreciate about the COVID background of this film is understanding that if I were with Chiwetel Ejiofor and he ran out onto the street every day reciting poetry loudly for the neighborhood, I would want to divorce him too.
I thought that was charming.
Embarrassing. Like, I was like, again, oh no, he's that guy.
I know.
He's that guy that wants to go out and be meaningful for people in public.
See, like, and that's early in the pandemic, they're still clanging pans for the NHS.
No, I know. I get it. Look, yeah. At the beginning of the pandemic, at the beginning of everything here in Los Angeles, our street became silent, much like the street out front of their apartment in this movie. But we have a guy in our neighborhood, and I've never seen him before the pandemic, but he began skateboarding. This guy's like close to our age. I can tell even yeah. from the kitchen window. He began skateboarding up and down the street on our block every single day, a few times a day. And he had the street to himself. And a year later, he's still doing it. And he doesn't have the street quite to himself anymore, but he will be damned if a car is going to get in his way. He is my dude on the skateboard. I don't know his name, but you know what he's not doing? He's not reciting poetry yet.
Hey, look, these are short poems.
Though. Look, in our neighborhood is the genesis for some version of lockdown that's a Fast and Furious movie, because what we get every once in a while are at our nearby intersection is people doing like drag racers doing donuts in an intersection for like 10 minutes and then until you hear the cops and then they take off. It's like it's crazy. It's like it'll be like midnight and then you'll all of a sudden for like 20 minutes and they're doing donuts in our local intersection.
Okay, but here's the thing, Dave. If you lived on a block where Chiwetel Ejiofor lived and Chiwetel Ejiofor sure, wanted to come out and read poems different. To you, you would be down for that.
Do you know why? Because he's Chiwetel Ejiofor. And I would say
it's the Mel Brooks story that he tells about Cary Grant on the side on the lot. I'm telling you, it would become that after day four, like I know, it's like not again, right?
No, I would appreciate it. I would appreciate it if Chiwetel Ejiofor came out and recited poetry to me on the street each day, because that's his job. I'm expecting him to do some kind of performance for me each day during lockdown, because his job is to be an actor and a performer. And so he's just keeping himself, his skills sharp on that aspect.
By the way, everyone look up that Mel Brooks anecdote about Cary Grant.
Oh, yeah. It is very funny.
You will be very happy.
It's a great Furthermore, story.
If Anne Hathaway were to put on yet another great Anne Hathaway outfit, and let me tell you, her outfits in this movie are chef's kiss. Like, yeah. She looks so pulled together all the time.
Even she dresses up for Zoom calls.
Even when she's not pulled together, and she looks like messy with no makeup and just got out of bed, she has
dancing
that,
in her pajamas.
She has that effortless sort of like, oh, I woke up like this kind of thing. If she were to come out the in the street and dance in her pajamas to an Adam and the Ants song like she does in this film, I'd be like, yeah, do it, Anne Hathaway. That's your job. Your job is to make me happy because you're Anne Hathaway.
Even
in a movie like this, which is not a great film, but I found quite entertaining, she's great. She's great. She's great all the time. Even in bad movies, Anne Hathaway is the thing you want to keep watching.
I don't know. I wasn't even able to, like, I feel like I couldn't even judge people's performances because I think this the whole thing was so home movie-ish to me that I just couldn't even, like, I thought it was, like, wrong to even say, like, who is, you know, not giving you as good a performance because I thought, like, okay, you know what? They're just trying to make something entertaining in a pandemic. It's not working for me, but fine.
I disagree. Like, I think it's very easy to, and I've seen movies that are genuinely just pandemic gimmicks. I had to sit through Songbird, you know. This movie, I felt like they were making an effort to, like, create characters and figure out how this pandemic would be affecting them. And, like, her whole monologue about why she started smoking again, I thought that was great. And it was like a reminder to me of, like, yeah, Anne Hathaway, we don't give her the credit she deserves. She is a terrific actress. And I thought she was really funny. And I love this movie a lot. I don't know why it hit me in a certain way. Again, like so many things of right now, maybe it's just hitting me this way because of the pandemic, you know. It's why, like, Dave and I were not all that amused by the second Borat movie while other people were, because it just felt too close to home. I don't know, but I really like Lockdown. I heartily endorse it. It is streaming on HBO Max. A movie that I think people are more on the side of is the latest from Thomas Vinterberg, Another Round, which had some kind of theatrical thing happening, but it's now available on demand.
It is currently streaming, and you can watch it in the virtual cinemas at your local independent art house kind of situation. If you live in Los Angeles, it's on lemley.com, L-A-E-M-M-L-E.
Even if you're not in Los Angeles, it's on lemley.com.
Even if you're not in Los Angeles, you can go there and watch it. The half the money goes to the movie theater, so yeah. It's a way to help a movie theater. So this is about a man who is a high school history teacher in Denmark, Mads Mikkelsen. And, you know, Vinterberg's mainstay over the years. And he's, you know, bored with life. His wife is a nurse, I guess, and she works nights. He doesn't see her very much because of it. The kids are teenagers, so of course they're ignoring him. And he's a little sort of disinterested, dispirited, not having a good time of it. It is showing in his work to the point where a group of parents and students meet with him and say, you know what? We've got these big college entrance exams coming up and you're not cutting it. We can't do well. We will not do well on these tests if you're not playing at your best here. So get on it. So he goes out to dinner with some friends. It's a friend's birthday. And one of the friends says, hey, I'm doing this. I'm reading about this study that suggests that everybody should constantly have one or two drinks in them at all times. In other words, the blood alcohol level of someone who has just had two glasses of wine, and you keep that blood alcohol level at that level all day. Why don't we try it?
For science.
For the sake of science. And so they all decide, okay, sure, we're going to try it. It's Vinterberg, not Vinterberg, it's Mikkelsen and these three other friends. So they do. And then there are consequences, as one might expect when people are buzzed all day long. Because after a while, they kick it up a notch and they're like,
yeah,
all right, now let's hover between absolute drunkenness and functionality. Can we do it? Well, you know what? It turns out that you cannot.
Because the buzz kind of works for a while.
Yeah. It gets them loose and happy and engaged and poised and confident and, you know, more charming and funnier. Did I say funny already? It doesn't matter. For a while it works, because I'll tell you, you go out to a bar or a party and you have one drink or two and you're thinking, all right, this feels nice. And then it all goes wrong. In life and in film, it all goes wrong.
Yeah, you're sort of watching this like slow motion thing where you're just like, no.
Yeah, yeah. You know, last week Manolo was with us talking about how, as a critic, it is an impossibility to take yourself out of the viewing of the film. You are always experiencing this film as a human being and not just as a critic. And so your everything that you bring with you to watching a film informs your understanding of that film, even to the point of how, you know, what kind of quality this film actually is. You saw this before I did, Alonzo.
Yes.
And the minute you finished seeing it, this was weeks ago.
No, this was months ago. I saw it for Toronto.
Oh, you saw it for Toronto. Well, you know, weeks, months, time, who cares? Exactly. Who knows? You came to me and you said, I really want you to watch this. And I was like, oh. I always know when you come to me and you say, I really want you to watch this, that there's something about it that you know will resonate with me personally, and you want to leech it out of me like a vampire. And so it turns out that, you know, my history of having grown up in wildly chaotic alcoholic homes did in fact inform my viewing of this film.
I thought it might.
Last week, you and I started watching Crazy Ex-Girlfriend for the very first time. I know we're way behind and it's already off the air and everyone's like, you know, but it was on our to-do list and it rose to the top. And in the first episode, she throws out her meds within the first 5 minutes. But they don't even explain to you why she takes meds. Just that it helps her in some way. And when she does this in the film, when she does this on the show, I became tense for the remainder of the pilot. Now, we haven't watched episode 2 yet, but I remain tense for this character because now I'm worried for this character. And the moment they all agreed to this experiment, I thought, what's coming, you know, because I've ridden in a car with an adult drunk at the wheel. And that's not a great feeling. And so when you see it on a screen happening to you, think, oh no, what's going to happen next? And so there was a lot of anxious tension for me while watching this, wondering how it would all resolve, knowing that it could not turn out especially well. It's not necessarily about alcoholism. It's, frankly, it's about the friendship between these four men and how this weirdly conceptual, you know, experiment that they try on each other is actually a catalyst for them to realize that none of them have been particularly attentive to their own interior lives or to the lives of their families or the people they love, their friendships, their jobs, nothing and everything.
Right.
So when it ends the way it ends, and I'm not going to spoil the ending, but it has a final scene that is so weird.
One of the best endings in recent memory.
It is one of the great endings.
Yeah, it's a great ending. And at the same time, I thought, I don't know that I would have gone this big or happy for the ending, because it doesn't feel like that's what the film deserves. So while I think this is a good movie, I'm watching it with a sense of the Al-Anon in me, saying like, you know what? No. Bad things happened, but the jubilance of this ending is sort of bugging me.
Well, there's the undercurrent of no, as you know, I think that's what's so great about the ending is that it doesn't pick a side there. It just sort of
And it's a balanced ending because it begins with a scene of the teenagers in the film,
right,
participating in what's known as the keg race or the beer race or something like that, where they have to run around a lake and drink a case of beer while they do it and then throw up on each other and stuff. And so these kids are having a great time binge drinking. In fact, the Danish title of this film, a word I cannot pronounce, but it's spelled D-R-U-K. So druk, whatever, means contextually, it means binge drinking. And so the finale of the film, again, teenagers are partying, but now the adults are with them and everyone's having a very good time. And I after having been put through that sort of, you know, tension ringer, I liked the breather that the ending gave me, but not the fact that it exists. Even though that ending is a great thing to look at for reasons, again, I don't want to give away because it's funny.
Well, look, I loved how completely irresponsible the story is. I mean, I don't know. To me, it actually tickled me that somebody would want to do this, and it almost felt like the way movies have dealt with alcoholism over the years is, for the longest time, it was a source of humor. You had characters whose whole image was like what W.C. Fields was built around, clearly just being drunk all the time. And at the same time, the movie started to kind of like address the perils of alcoholism. No movie ever wanted to do both at the same time. So I see
The Lost Weekend starring Foster Brooks.
So, I know. So to me, another round is like this just ambitious, like, you know, throw it all against the wall. Let's see what happens if we try to actually make you feel both as like Dave, like totally tense about everything because you know what the ramifications are. And there are, you know, there are some, but they're more emotional than like fatal. But just to get you to laugh and kind of get a drama out of it, both pertaining to alcohol.
There's a scene where a student who's been nervous about this like big oral exam, like you know, Mads Mikkelsen tells him to take a couple of shots beforehand, and it works.
I know. I mean, it walks that edge, and I think probably it maybe wouldn't have worked as well without someone like Mads Mikkelsen anchoring it, because there's just something about him that is serious and you want to laugh at him too because he's so.
What's so great about Mikkelsen in this movie is that like he is such a movie star, and yet he's playing this character who kind of goes from, you know, shut down and not attentive to his life and to the people around him, all that stuff, and then kind of coming alive with this experiment until the experiment goes too far and he's kind of back into being a mess again. And he conveys all of that stuff without ever like putting on a dumb wig, yeah, you know, or like just changing his posture, doing something that would like, see, I'm downtrodden now. Like it's a very delicate thread. And the look of the film too, it's shot by the woman who was the cinematographer of Victoria, which was that one take movie. And it's woman or man, actually, I'm not quite sure. The way that these guys come alive at the early part of this experiment, like the whole visual tone of the film changes. Like one of them coaches this terrible kids soccer team, but somehow like in this moment it looks like an ESPN house ad. It's like this, the most glorious soccer game you've ever seen, you know. I love how the movie's able to sort of shift into this kind of like burst of euphoria and then the hangover, and it's doing it all through the performances and through the way that it looks, but without ever clobbering you over the head with it.
I'm going to say that you guys are right about this film and that I am not distanced enough from it, because the subject matter pushes, you know, buttons in me that make me think, oh no, yeah, oh no, everything bad is coming. And
I know.
And so even when there's comedy involved, I was just thinking, you stop being funny right now, movie, because bad things are coming.
I know. You know what I mean? You know, movies aren't supposed to be for everybody. I mean, I'm sorry. it's good to be reminded of that occasionally with a movie that wants to just completely have a disreputable storyline and make it entertaining. And
Like the dinner where they decide they're going to do this, you know, Mickelson's character has already decided he's going to be the designated driver. And then the waiter not only keeps plying them all with like shots and wine and all these different rounds, but he like has the most florid descriptions of the vodka and of the wines. And it's just like, how do you say no to this?
Exactly.
So, yeah, I remember when
I fell in love with martinis. That was a great scene.
So yeah, I think this movie is really daring, and it's talking about alcoholism and talking about sort of, you know, these other kind of midlife crises and other issues the characters are facing in such a non-Hollywood way that I find really just bold and daring, and the way that Vinterberg always is. Like, if you go back and watch, like, you know, The Celebration or The Hunt or whatever, like, he really likes to push it, and he kind of puts the audience in these uncomfortable situations where, like, wait, who am I rooting for and why? And, right. You know, I very much am down for this one. And then finally, it is MLK weekend. We celebrate the MLK holiday on Monday, and it's the perfect timing for the release of the documentary MLK FBI that is now on demand from director Sam Pollard.
Yeah, Sam Pollard is, just one of the grand masters of a kind of archival documentary in that world as an editor and a director. And this is his documentary about kind of the FBI's really disgusting campaign to kind of discredit Martin Luther King Jr. Through surveillance and wiretapping and. Everything that, then, you know, initially it could, because like they saw all Black people protesting for their rights as, you know, susceptible to communism, that everything was filtered through the lens of communism. And they looked at Martin Luther King as, as a dangerous person. And so they kept tabs on him. And then when they found out that he was, had affairs, they thought that this was something that they could actually use against him. And so it became less about keeping tabs on somebody than it became really, really foul, trying to get him to commit suicide, you know, through a letter sent to Coretta, like anonymously. And like, this movie kind of, so it gives you the twin stories of Martin Luther King's, you know, rise as a figure in America and the FBI's, further descent into its probably worst days as a organization supposedly looking after our best interests.
And what Pollard does, you know, rather than do like talking at interviews, we don't see most of the people whose voices we hear until the very end of the film, but he creates this amazing collage of not just, you know, archival footage of King and of J. Edgar Hoover and like all these shots of the reams and reams of paperwork, you know, documenting the surveillance of King, but like the ongoing propaganda campaign to sort of prop up the FBI as being this like mythical, you know, heroic organization, you know, movies and TV shows and classroom films and just like this sort of constant messaging that they were very shrewd at crafting, you know, and so it kind of paints you this picture of, it's not just enough that we try and figure out how we're going to discredit and take down MLK, but it's also how we're going to make ourselves this kind of unassailable beacon of, you know, like American, you know, goodness and justice and rightness of putting this stuff together. Yeah, I mean, like, I knew a lot of the stuff about the FBI's campaign, but there is something about when a filmmaker can really kind of craft a context and a timeline.
The contextualization is great.
Yeah, which I just found really fascinating. And a thing I did not know is that, you know, a lot of this documentation was fairly recently declassified and made available to the public. in 2027, they are declassifying all the audio tapes, which means that all of the gross, like, motel room bugging things of Dr. King's sex life is going to be made accessible in 2027. And I'm curious to see what that means in terms of the discussion and understanding of Dr. King as a human being and not this icon, because I would like to think there'd be a way that even if we know this happened, and even if we're faced with the genuine evidence that these guys have of this stuff that is nobody's business but his own, that can be accepted by society at large without in any way interfering with his, you know, extraordinary record as an activist for justice and for civil rights and for the poor and against the Vietnam War and all the great stuff that he accomplished.
Yeah, it's we'd like to think that, like, having a 50-year head start on a reputation will hopefully make it, you know, it'll be 60 years, 70, so that when we do find out things doesn't overshadow it, you know. And it's, you know, this movie goes into one of the more controversial, you know, things that have come out that, you know, some historians don't know that we should be believing right now. It's not worth mentioning out, you know, on this, because it is in the documentary. But it's interesting because he's got the people that he interviewed or that are interviewed in it that you don't see are some historians who have amongst themselves been conflicted about the mentioning of certain things in public that have been unearthed in these tapes. Right. In one case, it's not on a tape. It's actually just a notation on a form by a, you know, by a G-man who, you know, as some of the historians rightly point out, these people were, you know, conditioned to look for the worst things that's what their bosses wanted. So why wouldn't they occasionally maybe, like, you know, make something up or assume something that wasn't true?
And they were almost uniformly, as the film points out, like, you know, white conservative, you know, right. Cut from the same mold.
Yeah, if you know your bosses terrible. Want this stuff, what would stop you from kind of like embellishing?
Yeah.
Terrible white conservatives, terrible conservatives in general, will take the information from this film, which has been, you know, knowledge for some time. They touch on it in the film Selma and in other, iterations of the Martin Luther King Jr. story. They will use this information for their own awful ends. And the day the audio becomes available, they will do the same thing. But the fact has to remain that, first of all, human beings are human beings, and they can do great, amazing, wonderful things for the world. And at the same time, they can have trouble in their life that, you know, is expressed privately and has no bearing on what they've done that's good.
Right.
Also, these are things that are done in private that should have been remained in private. And the shame involved here is solely on the shoulders of the FBI and the United States government, because they did this, all of it, in the service of perpetuating racist, white supremacist legal structures, social structures, every kind of, you know, institution that exists in this country is predicated on that. And so the shame here has nothing to do with Martin Luther King Jr. and everything to do with the FBI.
Well, what I find really interesting is that it's not like the FBI was keeping this a secret. They were sharing this information with certain journalists, with certain other people in the movement. Like, they were trying to kind of like get somebody else to take down King for them, armed with the information that they had gotten. And people wouldn't do it. Like, they wouldn't take the bait. And I find that kind of fascinating, that it was sort of like, yeah, no, we're not going to, I'm not going to do this for you.
I mean,
you know?
In the 50s, they stopped being an investigative arm and they started the COINTELPRO, and the whole purpose of that was to try to infiltrate, you know, and disrupt, you know, legitimate organizations that were, you know, fighting for people's rights.
To sow chaos.
Yeah. I'll, you know, but
But I just think it's great that like the sort of collectively, like the rest of the civil rights movement and even like certain reporters and stuff were like, this might be a thing. You might have the evidence here, but where his work is more important than this. So we're just not going to like, you know, we're not going to take easy bait.
There's a beautiful,
but I want to say like, oh, go ahead, Dave.
There's a beautiful visual moment near the end when you do see the people who've been talking and you get to see them talking. Mm. And I am now blanking on the man who is saying this and who does this thing, but he says, does this information exist? Yes, it's factual information. Does it matter? And he shrugs.
I think it's Clarence Jones.
I love that dismissive shrug, because that's what I was just talking about. You know what? Whose business? Not yours. The FBI is the villain here. The United States government is the villain here. And here's my reaction to it. A shrug.
Although it's just, it's an interesting parallel to the times that we're in now, to watch a movie about such a concerted effort to prevent
dissent.
You know, dissent. Yeah. And while not looking at what the real problem is,
exactly. Like
that's, I mean, that it is in that respect. And I just want to say about Sam Pollard, who is just an expert at these things. And I mean, archival documentaries are really hard to do. I mean, he does have voiceover, but one of the great things you can do with archival film is not just use it as a, it's not a placeholder while you listen to somebody talk. It is used, clips are used to kind of help tell the story. And so he's so good at that. This is such a wonderfully edited movie. I just recommend it as filmmaking. It's just so good.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, you know, there's, when you talk about documentaries so often, it's like, well, if the story is good enough, you're willing to maybe look the other way at like the presentation not being that great. Or sometimes it does not telling you anything very interesting, but you just want to look at it. And this one does it all.
There's a great sequence when the people we're hearing talk are talking about the emotional turmoil King was going through at the time, knowing he was being like kind of like investigated by the FBI, but trying to like, you know, navigate his new political friendships and figure out what the next step is and the things that are weighing on him. And they just choose the clips from King at that time that have a certain kind of like, you can read into his face that he's thinking about things, that he's that he may be dealing with something in the moment, but also have something on his mind. I mean, these are just some of the things that, as an archival documentary filmmaker, are just, you know, just it's so good. It's not just here's some clips to you know, keep you looking while it's not
him making a speech. It's him getting off an airplane, and so like he's not giving you the like public face. He's giving you the private,
right. Yeah, it's just like true like historian as filmmaker stuff. I just really good.
Yeah,
Pollard worked on Eyes on the Prize, that great civil rights documentary from years ago, and
he also, he's produced like some of the Spike Lee stuff, like I think When the Levees Break and Four Little Girls.
Yeah, and he's also co-director on Mr. Soul, this really really fantastic documentary from last year too.
Cool. Dave, I believe we have some five-star reviews to read. Leave us a five-star review on Apple Podcasts. We'll read it on the show. We got a little backlog, but we're going to catch up today.
In lieu of letters this week, we have some self-aggrandizing five-star reviews.
Nice.
Let Grandpa put his glasses on, because boy, howdy, this email is tiny, tiny print. In fact, the names of the people who have sent these five-star reviews is in such small type that I cannot
read it. I'll read those.
Wait a second. I got one. Ron AAP.
Okay.
Yeah. Says, I'm a big fan of this podcast. I also just purchased Mr. Giraldi's book, Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. My wife and I are loving it.
Yay. Thank you.
From Susie
Q 24668.
I've been listening for a year now. Love the friendly format. Can't wait each week for a new one to see how the guys are doing. We're fine.
We're good.
We're doing okay. Thank you for asking. And what they watched that week. I've watched so many movies I've never found. If it were not for Dave and Alonzo, first found them on the All Things Cozy podcast.
Thank you, Susie Q.
Pick up, scrolling down. Sorry, this is not, this is being real clunky for me. Sorry.
This is from First and Only Podcast Review.
I found this podcast by way of What the Flick and haven't looked back. I love the conversations about movies that are not in the mainstream. Of course, they still review the next Marvel movie, but they also review an independent Brazilian film that 15 people in the world have seen, and I love them for that. They've really opened my eyes to cinema that I wouldn't have seen otherwise. For that, I say thank you. I do have two minor criticisms. When I listen to the podcast, I have to turn it up louder to hear it at the same volume as other podcasts. This is especially noticeable if I have a GPS navigation. Second, why is Alonzo's podcast Film and a Movie not on Stitcher?
I will ask. Yeah. I'll ask Bran, our producer, about that one.
Yeah, Alonzo, why?
Yeah.
The next one is from another name I cannot read.
BN Rissler.
Okay. I was brought to David Alonzo by way of the sadly deceased Pop Rocket. I'm not particularly a cinephile. I'm more of a TV lady, but through their reviews, I learned what movies are worth spending my time and money on. Their banter absolutely warms my heart. For a girl growing up as a progressive in the Midwest, it's nice to hear worldviews similar to my own. I feel like I'm being invited into their home, and I can practically smell the tart that Dave is inevitably baking. I would like to give them an honorary sixth, that word is so hard.
Sixth
star for their fun social media accounts, for being the coolest people to ever like some of my posts. Subscribe now. And then scrolling down, I'm not being allowed to scroll down.
That's it. That's the last one.
Oh, there's only four of them.
Yes.
All right.
So great. Thank you all for sending those in. We appreciate it. And leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. We'll read it on the show. You can also leave us thumbs up or whatever positive feedback on streaming platforms like Stitcher and Spotify and Google Play and CastBox, Podbean, Amazon Music, wherever you can find us.
Shall I talk about Patreon?
Please.
Shall I? All right. Here's your 15-second Patreon ad by us, about us, for us. Patreon.com/linoleumknife is where you go if you want more content. There is a show called Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, where we talk about one movie in depth. There is a show called LKTV, where it's about TV. There is a show called Linoleum Knife and Fork, which we mentioned earlier in the show, because every once in a while, we have a third co-host named Margie Rockland, married to this Robert Abley right here.
Woo-hoo!
It is a podcast about food. It's about all those tarts. Then there's Linoleum Nights, which is about whatever we want it to be about on any given week. And it's the one that isn't clean. It's the one where we use all the F words that we don't use on this show. I'm surprised. Well, no, I'm not surprised, because Robert, we didn't have to bleep you even one time. We thought we were going to get some competition out of you, because Manola last week said F 3 times in a row, and it was great.
I know the rules of the show, and I follow rules. I said frickin'. That's why I said frickin' at one time.
We bleeped her, but we were happy to do it.
Yes. We didn't want to slow her roll in any way.
Not at all.
Robert Abley, we always love having you on. Thanks for being here. How can folks
it's a pleasure. A pleasure to thank you guys.
How can folks find you online?
Twitter is at R.A. Abley. Basically, my middle initial is Arthur, so the A is in there. And you can read me at the L.A. Times website. In fact, I want to mention this great Romanian documentary that I reviewed last week called A Casa, My Home, which is worth everybody's time, about a Roma family living in a wetlands preserve outside of Bucharest and what happens to them. And it's a fantastic documentary.
I need to check that one out, because my favorite movie of 2020 was a Romanian documentary. So I got to keep that train rolling. you can follow us on social media at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook, and drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Please do check out my other podcasts, Breakfast All Day, Who Shot Ya, and A Film and a Movie. And we are thrilled that you joined us this time. We'll be back next week with more. Until then,
goodbye.